Sunday, April 21, 2024. I'm Anthony Davis. Welcome to The Weekend Show, where we make the time to consider the news of the week. You can support my work and independent journalism at patreon.com/5minutenews. Our guest today is a former Trump staffer turned anonymous whistleblower who exposed the former president's misconduct while in office. His book, Blowback, is the product of almost 100 conversations with former Trump officials and warns of the danger of a second Trump presidency. Miles Taylor, welcome to The Weekend Show.
It's great to be with you, my friend.
So firstly, I want to talk about the role of the whistleblower and how, for me as a European, you know, seeing the US through a European lens, whistleblowers, I found in America, seem to be looked down upon, whereas where I'm from, they are celebrated and worthy of medals of honor. So, you know, obviously it takes a lot to want to blow the whistle, especially when you are, I mean, you describe yourself as a lifelong conservative and somebody who was working in national security. So just if you can explain how, I think not just yourself, but other people who Trump might refer to as the deep state are able to maintain their role no matter who the administration is, but then feel the need to go against their own political allegiance and speak up.
There's a lot to unpack there, and you know, and hopefully this will be valuable to the folks that are listening. And as we were talking about in the green room, Anthony, this is definitely going to be the most watched and most listened to episode ever. And I don't know if you announced this, Midas Touch is offering up a Lamborghini for right. One guest that listens to the show this week. No, I'm kidding. Look, I've struggled with the word whistleblower and whether I even am one or not. I mean, when you come forward, not just in politics to sound the alarm, but really in anything now, you are met instantly with crowdsourced opinions, sometimes violently supportive, sometimes just violent. And I was called everything, a traitor and a hero and a disgruntled employee by the president and a, you know, savior of democracy. And I don't think I'm any of those things. I don't think I'm a hero. I don't think I'm a traitor. I think I just did my job. And that job was more than just being the chief of staff of a government department. That job was being an American public servant. And as everyone knows, you don't swear allegiance to the president of the United States. You swear allegiance to the Constitution. And so the point at which you are being asked to do things that are literally by definition legally anti-constitutional is when your obligation supersedes your boss. And the only authority you are accountable to if something is in contravention of the Constitution are the American people themselves. They are the sovereign. They are the voters. They are the ones to decide whether to rehire or fire the person who executes the laws of the United States. And, you know, in that standpoint, if coming forward to reveal that anti-constitutional activity makes me a traitor, then I'm a traitor. You know, and if it makes me a whistleblower, then I'm a whistleblower. But, you know, one of the things I've found, Anthony, in wrestling with this term is that people who end up falling into that category, like you said, of whistleblower, are being treated very differently right now in the United States. There is a lot of animosity towards the folks who have come out to disclose Donald Trump's behavior and his inclinations towards illegality. But, you know, you interview each of those people, which I did for Blowback, almost all of them that have come forward and spoken out about him, I interviewed them. And one of the first questions I had for all of my peers that have gotten into this mess is, would you do it again? And I did not expect the universality of the answer that I received from those people, almost to a person. And we're talking about people who've lost their homes and their jobs and everything, people who've just blown up their lives to turn against the guy. Almost to a person, they've said, yes, I would do it again. And I think that's one of the few hallmarks of a whistleblower that I've found is that despite all of the blowback, which is the term of the book, but despite all the blowback that can come from it, people still feel like going and telling the truth was more valuable. That is a powerful message to me. And again, is not something that I thought was a foregone conclusion as I started to huddle with some of these folks.
just explain to us about the term blowback, because it's actually a term used to describe unintended consequences within the realm of national security, right?
Yeah, you know, originally that term was used a lot in the world that I spent most of my career in the national security realm. And usually blowback is meant to signify the unintended consequences of when you fail to see around a corner. You know, so if you're deploying a convoy into somewhere like Somalia to go intercept a terrorist suspect, you know, if you fail to plan correctly for that mission or fail to take certain elements into account, you might experience blowback. It might mean the convoy gets attacked or ambushed. And I've expropriated the term into this world that we are walking into as a country. Namely, if we fail to anticipate what will happen if we return Donald Trump to the White House, then we could suffer the unintended consequences. The blowback could be quite severe. And quite frankly, Anthony, the book was born out of a lot of frustration. And I don't want to knock, you know, my peers that have spoken out from the Trump administration, but generally a lot of people left that administration and went and wrote self-laudatory books about just how amazing they were. And too few were painting a picture for us of what could happen if that guy came back to power. And so finally I said, you know, I'm just going to go do it. I'm going to go paint as lucid of a portrait as I can of what a second term would look like under Donald Trump or a savvier successor if he doesn't make it back into the White House, because that's what we need to foresee in order to prevent blowback. We need someone to give us a little bit of a crystal ball and say, you know, here's what the guy will do, so we can make that choice in November with very, very clear eyes. And so that's what I set out to do with this. And it's not the book I wanted to write. You know, I did not want to write this book. I don't want to be promoting this book. I don't want to be talking about it, because I never anticipated we would be so foolish to put ourselves back in this same damn predicament. But we have. And so it's important to talk honestly about what the repercussions will be.
I want to talk about the danger of a future Trump presidency a little bit later. But first, I want to talk about this polarization that means that there are a core Trump support, a core number of Trump supporters who see you as, you know, somebody who's done the wrong thing rather than the right thing. And that is due to this compartmentalization where people think that you're either in one camp or the other. If you say anything bad about Donald Trump, you must be a Democrat or a snowflake or something. There's very little gray. You know, it's all black and white in the narrative. And the media does play into that as well. So let's just talk about this notion. And I mean, we've heard similar from Alexander Vindman, for example, who, you know, was listening on the phone call when Trump tried to extort Vladimir Zelensky. He was just doing his job. He didn't feel like he was being a whistleblower either. And yet, because Trump was the president, he saw it as an anti-Trump action rather than something that had a higher cause. So just to react to this notion that how, because I'm very keen to define what Trump is trying to say is the deep state, and make people realize that actually that the government, the federal government, is made up of really very good people, no matter their political allegiance.
Well, it is. And look, I will start off by saying I remain a conservative. And I, in fact, think Donald Trump is not a conservative. I am ideologically, philosophically, intellectually a conservative as defined in American politics. And we don't have to go into political philosophy here and go deep. But for those that are well-read enough, I mean, I'm a Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, what they would call a classical liberal, but is you know, over the past few decades assumed the terminology of a conservative in American politics. I'm a small L libertarian. And that means that I'm actually not a huge fan of Joe Biden's policies. But why did I vote for Joe Biden in 2020 after serving for Donald Trump? And why do I continue to support him for the presidency in 2024? Is because you have to, in a circumstance like this, put country over party. You have to say there are things more important than my party's policy positions. And so, you know, I still believe very strongly in that. I think it's very important. But, you know, you do have folks who've become so tribal that they have difficulty even seen that justification. And, you know, Trump has tried to portray anyone who's spoken out against him from within the Republican Party as the deep state, which has been, it's sort of, I have almost needed no opportunity to argue against that, because as he makes the case, it feels self-defeating. Because when he went into office, he said, I'm bringing in a team and we're going to take out the deep state. The implication being the deep state were left-leaning government bureaucrats. And then dozens and dozens and dozens of the people he took in with him, like me, turned against him and said, you're a bad man. You are a bad, bad man. Like, actually, fundamentally, just a horrible person and an idiot when it comes to public policy, and a terrible president. And then he's labeled them the deep state. It's a tough argument to make that you went in to detonate it with your team, and then your team somehow got corrupted by the deep state. Now, I'm going to add an asterisk to that, Anthony, because here's the place, ironically, I might agree with the former president, is I think people like me made it a little bit easier for him to make that case. Now, I initially leveled my accusations against the president anonymously, and that did two things. One, and I still believe this, one, it drew a ton of public attention to those revelations. That's why I did it. I was not stupid in doing that. I did it because I know people are so attracted to a spectacle that writing those opinions anonymously would force them to get attention. It was the most viral opinion piece in the history of the New York Times. I got their attention. But it did a second thing, is it gave Trump ammunition to say, look at these cloak and dagger people in the deep state. He was able to turn that anonymity against me and to reinforce his narrative. And it's one of the reasons why at the time I said I'm eventually going to come forward and unmask myself before the election, is because I was worried he would only weaponize this. You know, the veil was just meant to draw people's attention long enough to focus on the message instead of the messenger. But if you stay in the shadows too long, you do reinforce that narrative of, you know, people who are scheming. And so I felt like it was important to come forward. And in some ways, ironically, the revelations backfired. And it's one of the things that I say in this book is, it sounds funny coming from me, but I think one of the biggest threats to our democracy is anonymity. And let me explain to you what I mean. It's the willingness of people to express a strong moral view in private and be scared to do it in their own names in public. And it's what got us into this mess. In the Republican Party, most of my peers were, quote unquote, anonymous. They all could have written the op-ed that I wrote. They all felt the same way about Trump, but everyone was scared shitless to do it. And the consequence of that is that we elected the man, and we might reelect the man, because there's still so many people in the hierarchy of the Republican Party who share my views in private, but won't say them publicly. And so anonymity is a danger. And I learned that the hard way, because ironically, when I came forward anonymously and I said the president's cabinet is keeping him in check and there, you know, we are restraining his worst impulses. Do you know what Donald Trump's response was to that? He went and fired almost all of the adults in the room. And I found out much later from people like Stephanie Grisham, who was his comms director. Stephanie said, oh yeah, he would talk about it all the time in the Oval Office. Everyone who walked in that door, he would ask us afterwards, do you think that was anonymous? Do you think that was anonymous? And he systematically started to essentially exterminate the adults in the room, so that by the end of the first term, it was a lot of sycophants. And so in some ways, my plan backfired. It actually accelerated the chaos. And that's why I think it's really important this cycle for folks not to play games. Don't give the off the record quotes on how dangerous this man is. Come forward, own it. Let's have a real conversation and be a little bit civically courageous.
And it was a great personal cost to you as well, losing your job in the private sector, losing a relationship, addiction. You know, there was a whole, the ramifications of speaking out were significant. And we're even seeing that at the moment. I mean, I'm glued to the select committee hearing on Boeing and whistleblowers at Boeing, you know, after those two crashes and then a plug door blowing out. And you can see the nervousness even in the Boeing employees who still have their jobs for fear of retribution there. You know, to speak up in this country does require an enormous amount of strength, doesn't it?
It requires some element of something. Maybe it's strength. maybe it's a moment of craziness to come forward, but I think it requires something more. And it's not necessarily from the person who makes the disclosure. It's from the rest of us. And that is, it's easier to go out and tell the truth if you know that other people are going to have your back by also telling the truth. So put in a much more simple way, cowardice is contagious, but courage is also contagious. And folks are more inclined to go make honest revelations, to tell the truth and speak the truth, if they think it's not costly to speak the truth. And I say this a lot in front of when I speak to audiences of students who are, you know, in college and taking econ class. I tell them, look, think of supply and demand curves. In any marketplace, if the price of something is really high, if the cost of it is really high, there's only two ways to lower the cost. And right now in our country, the cost of dissent, of speaking up, it's super high. Yes, it cost me everything. So, okay, how do you lower that price? There's only two ways, econ tells us. One, you can either decrease the demand for something and the price goes down. But we don't really want to decrease the demand for truth because that's kind of dumb. Like, we don't want to live in a world of lies. So the only other way mathematically is you have to increase the supply. That's the only way you get the price to go down. In this case, we need to increase the supply of dissent. And it sounds like a kindergarten lesson, but it's real. If in our own communities, we're scared to speak up and tell the truth about the craziness in our politics, well, then the price of dissent is going to be pretty high for the person that does. They're going to go get stoned by the extremists. But if everyone kind of bands together, the price goes down, the cost goes down. It's not as hard for the next person and the next person and the next person to dissent. And I learned this through trial and error. I probably tried every wrong way to do the right thing before landing on the right one. And in the course of that, I did learn that finally coming forward in my own name had that effect on some of my friends and peers who I was waiting to come forward. It was the classic bystander phenomenon where people are on a subway train in New York and someone's getting the shit kicked out of them and no one steps forward. Why? Because no one else had already stepped forward. They're all waiting for each other. Once I made my revelations, yes, did it detonate my personal life? Catastrophically. It was Chernobyl to my personal life. But then I looked to my left and my right and I had peers who had been thinking about doing the same finally ring me up on the phone and say, let's do it. I'm in. Like, I'll make a video. I'll come forward. That was a powerful moment for me. And it showed it takes a tribe of the tribeless, if you will, to be able to make that more and more possible. And I actually think we're breaking through. I mean, and I don't just mean anti-Trumpers. I think generally folks who are willing to dissent are going and having people's backs. And privately, I've never said this before. I mean, I do this when I see other people come forward, not just in politics, but in other situations and blow the whistle and do something tough. I often try to reach out to those folks and say, hey, look, I'm happy to give you some private advice on, look, how to protect your family, how to protect your friends, what to do next. Like, I've been through this, but also just to say, you're not alone. You are in a fraternity now of people who are doing the right thing. And that fraternity or sorority is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Welcome. Don't kick yourself for having done it. That's important for all of us to do when we see someone speak up, even in just the workplace or the classroom.
So let's shine that light on the current GOP and the way in which, I mean, even people like Mitch McConnell, who got up after January 6th and blamed Donald Trump, you know, in very clear language, has now endorsed him. We've seen a few Congress people hand in their notice, won't be rejoining next time. Bit of a cowardly way to exit stage left, in my opinion. But in terms of the people that have stood up to Donald Trump, you can really count them on one hand. Obviously, Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, who you know. But I also feel like there is this kind of cult-like mentality amongst the leadership. It's not just the base, the people wearing the MAGA hats, but the cult-like mentality amongst the political leaders, the Congress people, the senators. So could you just talk to those people, and why is it? I should just say very quickly, I've been reading old Ronald Reagan speeches. Don't ask me why. But I was reading one yesterday about some remarks he made at a Senate Republican unity dinner in November 1984. And the line that really caught my eye, halfway through the speech, he said, "And I know that we Republicans will stick together as united as the union our party long ago fought to preserve." Is this the issue, really, is that actually Republicans behind the scenes in leadership have a plan that you never criticize the leader, and you band together no matter what?
Well, I mean, look, I'll try to be fair here, because I think both the political parties in this country have that problem. It's not as pronounced and extreme at the moment on the left, but you know, you saw people when Nancy Pelosi was speaker, sometimes, you know, moderates who tried to stand up against the whatever they call them, the crew, the clan,
the squad.
Who am I thinking of? The squad. You know, people who stood up against the squad sometimes got shot down, and there was a little bit of silence in there. I mean, this happens in politics. Politics is tribal. But I think what we're seeing right now in the Republican Party is without any precedent in the history of the Republic. That might sound hyperbolic to some ears. You know, take it from me, having spent my life inside the party, there ain't nothing to compare to this. Not even George Washington. He didn't even command this level of cultish adulation as Donald Trump does. And, you know, there's something I write about in the book, Anthony, that I think exemplifies this, is that when Trump was president, a couple of times he tweeted a pretty crazy thing. He kept comparing himself weirdly to Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan. And I didn't understand it at the time. He, you know, if there was a poll about his support within the GOP, you know, you can go find these tweets. It's like 93% of Republicans supported him. And he would tweet it and he'd say, I'm more popular than Reagan was in the Republican Party or Lincoln, leaving aside the fact that there were no opinion polls within the Republican Party of Lincoln at the time. But let's just take him at his word. I thought this was crazy at the time that he kept trying to compare himself to other Republicans. And I realized it was born of his insecurity. But much later, I realized something more significant, is those claims he was making weren't absurd. They were spot on. He was right. Donald Trump realized something that most of us conservatives didn't, which is that he was commanding a different type of adulation than even a Reagan or perhaps even a Lincoln had commanded within the party, because people were literally worshiping him, and they still do. They have made Trump a part of their religion. I mean, there are folks who've been so heavily radicalized by this man that they won't accept any frank descriptions of things that people like I have seen about him behind the scenes. They just refuse to believe it. They cover their ears. This man can do no wrong. We didn't see the deification of Ronald Reagan like that. Maybe you could make an argument that Lincoln, in his, you know, in a sort of martyrdom state for the Union, was treated with that level of reverence. But even then, the things that were seen from within the party, you can't find historical analog for folks falling over themselves to line up behind the guy, despite privately portraying a very, very, very different opinion of the man. So I do think it's remarkable. I think Trump is right in the fact that his support is greater in some ways than those former presidents. And that's actually something for us to worry about, because our founders worried, and they wrote extensively about the danger of a demagogue assuming power in the United States. And they actually tried to design the Department of the Executive to be somewhat resistant to that type of person. And those guardrails failed. We ended up electing a Donald Trump. And I think now we're witnessing exactly what they had warned about. And unfortunately, I'm not convinced those guardrails will be able to hold in a second term. That really, that last final guardrail is the electorate. And if the electorate can't save us from a second Donald Trump term, I will tell you, nothing can. The judiciary, the legislative branch, they won't be able to resist the corrupt behavior that we will see infuse the executive in a second term. And I say that in all seriousness.
I want to expand on that in just a moment and talk about who you believe Trump to be behind the scenes. Got to take a quick break. We'll come back and do that next here on The Weekend Show. I'm excited to tell you about Moink. That's Moo plus Moink. Moink is a meat subscription box company on a mission to fight for the family farm. They're located in rural America, run by an eighth generation female farmer. Their animals are raised humanely, their employees are paid a living wage, and the quality of their product is better than anything you'll find in a store. Moink delivers grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and sustainable wild-caught Alaskan salmon straight to your door. I've received one of these boxes, and I can verify that the quality of the food was excellent, and it tasted delicious too. Keep American farming going by signing up at moinkbox.com/weekend now, and listeners of this show get free bacon for a year. That's 1 year of the best bacon you'll ever taste, but for a limited time. Spelled M-O-I-N-K box.com/weekend. That's moinkbox.com/weekend. 10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base? How about businesses on Shopify? When we started podcasting, an online store was the furthest thing from our minds. Now we're selling t-shirts and Midas Touch merch, and it's so easy, all because we use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch of your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're delivering daily digests or serving sensational scoops, Shopify will help you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds and Rothney's and Brooklinen and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success at every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/weekend. Go to shopify.com/weekend now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/weekend. We're back. I'm Anthony Davis. Miles Taylor joins us. We talk about Trump having multiple personalities, aside from a personality disorder, which is widely covered, although not covered as much as I would like, but there we are. Tell us about, from working in the administration, the stuff that you write about in the book is compelling. It's almost like a thriller, the way the book reads like a thriller in that way. Government should not work like that. It's supposed to be boring. It's supposed to be administrative. Just talk to us about, how Trump behaved and the things that he was stopped from doing that you describe that he will certainly do on his tour of retribution if he was to win a second term.
Well, if you really want to understand this man, you have to listen to his words and take them seriously. And I'm going to make a comparison here that fellow conservatives would cry foul about, but it's to Osama bin Laden. And no, Donald Trump is not bin Laden. In some ways, I think he's doing more damage to American democracy. But I'm going to make the comparison because the reason we underestimated Osama bin Laden when he was the leader of the Al-Qaeda jihadist movement was because we didn't take his words seriously. But if you go back, bin Laden was very clear about what he wanted to do, about his worldview. I mean, he wrote it out in long letters and speeches that forecast all of his plans. Donald Trump has done the exact same thing. And he has talked about how he wants to run a second administration as a retributive president, that he wants to get revenge against his enemies, that he wants to use the powers of government to go after his political enemies. He means it. You need to take him seriously. Whether you're MAGA or whether you're a progressive, please take the man seriously. That's what he wants to do. He would like to come in and systematically rewire federal departments and agencies to act on his behalf to advance his personal self-interests and to get retribution against his enemies. If you think it's more complicated than that, you don't understand Donald Trump. That's what he wants to do with your federal government. Now, you can be a conservative, you can be a MAGA person, and hopefully look at that and say, yeah, you know, I pay like 30 or 40% in taxes. It's kind of a lot. I don't like it, but I definitely don't like it if I'm just paying for one guy to go in and get back at people who've pissed him off. It seems like kind of a waste of my money. But that's what he wants to do in a second term. Now, I'll give you an anecdote that I think was very revealing. I was in a meeting with the president, the ex-president, Donald Trump, in the Oval Office, and this was March of 2019. And we were having a conversation about a foreign policy, about a foreign policy deal that we were trying to close with a foreign government. And at the time, it did not make sense to me why Donald Trump made this segue in the conversation. But we're sitting there, the lights in the Oval Office were turned off, and it was the afternoon. So there's like sunlight coming in. He, of course, is drinking a sweaty Diet Coke on the table, and we're chatting. And he said something to the effect of, you know, I learned when I was in business that when, you know, when you want something, you know, you have to actually go and get it. And, you know, you can't just threaten to sue someone. Okay. Like you can't just threaten, because if you threaten to sue them, people will say, and they'll blow you off. You have to just sue them, whether you have a case or not. And they settle like babies. You know, he said some version of that.
Right.
And, you know, at the time, I remember thinking this is very weird, but you think back to Donald Trump's career and his disposition, whether he had a case or not, was to go sue his adversaries. Because once you sue them, they face the prospect of court costs and discovery and all these things. And so they just want to settle. Put more simply, you develop leverage over them that you didn't have before. It ended up being very relevant to the conversation we were having about a foreign partner at the time, but it's also how Donald Trump viewed every action in government. He was on a constant quest for leverage. Where can I get leverage over someone else and use that leverage to get the thing that I want? Now, that's not inherently a bad thing. You know, in any negotiation, let's say, with a foreign power, yeah, the United States might want leverage and use that leverage to advance its interest. But this is different. This is a man looking for personal leverage to get the thing that he personally wants, and not for the country. That's the Donald Trump you will see in a second term. That's the person behind the scenes, is a man who's constantly hunting for ways to get leverage over his enemies. How will that manifest in government in a way that actually affects your everyday Americans? Well, one of the examples I go back to that I saw a lot in Homeland Security was emergency response. Is when Donald Trump would see disaster strike around the country, it's the president's job to sign these disaster declarations and send federal aid. But if a disaster happened in a blue state, Donald Trump saw an opportunity, because he was like, ah, this is a place where there's a governor that doesn't like me, people who didn't vote for me, maybe I don't sign that disaster declaration. Or maybe I call up the governor and see if he's willing to cut me a deal. That was his mindset. And we saw that happen actually in several circumstances. We talked him off of it, but it's the type of thing that will happen in a second term. He will deliver federal assistance selectively and retributively in a way that gives him leverage over his adversaries. That's very weird. And it's not how we expect government to operate.
We saw that in Puerto Rico, didn't we? In that terrible moment where he was throwing toilet paper at people. I mean, does this make the point, though, that actually someone from the business community does not make a great president? And that, you know, because obviously there's that whole argument about trickle-down economics, and there's no proof that it actually works, but it is a conservative argument time and time again that if you deregulate business and give them those, you know, the tax breaks, that eventually the working man will be able to benefit. I mean, there's no proof of that. But, you know, that's really, a lot of conservatives are still voting Republican despite Donald Trump, because they think a businessman or a wealthy person in office is a good thing, because wealth equates to success, and that their tax liability might be reduced. I mean, how do we get to the point where we are allowing a demagogue, a dictator, an autocrat, potentially a second term, just because some people don't want to pay a higher rate of tax?
Well, Anthony, this is where I'm going to have to disagree with you, my friend, because I would say, as a conservative, a great businessman makes a great president because you want someone who's very efficient at managing a large organization and doing things that great business leaders do, which is great business leaders, if you go down to the brass tacks about what makes them effective, the best in the world tend to communicate and delegate. They articulate the strategic priorities very well, and they delegate responsibility to their subordinates in a way that carries out that vision faithfully and with integrity. And they're really, really good at that. But I'm going to go back to the beginning, because a great businessman makes a great president, in my view. Donald Trump is not a great businessman. He is a failed businessman across the board. Trump steaks and Trump vodka and Trump airlines, and we could go on and on. A rejoinder, though, might be folks who say, but no, he's rich, so he must be a great businessman. Well, Al Capone was rich. Al Capone was incredibly rich. You can be rich and not be a great businessman. You can be a fraud. And we've seen this with Donald Trump throughout his history. The man, even people who've been huge supporters of his, have come away saying he's a total fraud. He swindled me in this business deal or that business deal. So I do still think great businessmen can make great presidents, but he is not one. And in fact, all the characteristics that made him a failed businessman, he took into the White House. And in a lot of ways, he made the U.S. government his largest failed venture yet. He rendered so many departments and agencies effectively incapable of discharging their duties because of his volatility and his corrupt nature. I saw it in our own department. It was supposed to be my job to support the work of the 250,000 men and women under me at the Department of Homeland Security. But instead, because the president was so impulsive, I had to spend all of my time focused on one person. I had to spend my time focused on how do we manage the president. That's not the sign of a good businessman. He's clearly not communicating and delegating really well. That's the sign of the exact opposite. And that's just how he governed in a first term with those quote unquote guardrails in place. I think it would be a great deal worse in a second term. I don't think business leaders should get too excited about a Trump second term being better for them economically than a Biden term. And I hear this argument from Wall Street execs and Wall Street billionaires that it'll be better under Trump than it has been under Biden. If there's one thing that matters to American businesses, it's stability, it's consistency. It's why we live in a land of laws. It's why the rule of law is good for economies and democracies and for human flourishing. A second Donald Trump term will be so volatile, from our relations with the world to domestic policy to the stability of the executive branch itself, that I think it will be very dangerous and destabilizing for American businesses and American trade. And I think it's important for conservatives to know that.
Talk to me with your expertise in national security about the security threat of Donald Trump, because, you know, we often talk about the security clearances that you know, in the real world, he would never have been able to achieve, let alone Jared Kushner and a whole bunch of people that worked in the White House at a senior level, talking about, you know, his aides and surrogates. You know, there is a real security issue here, isn't there? And in fact, the fact that he now has a publicly trading company with shares that people can buy, which he uses, you know, in his own spiel to try and artificially inflate the value of. I mean, anybody could buy those shares and try to curry favor with a future president. That combined with, you know, his history of stealing classified documents and sharing the information, as he did famously with an Australian businessman. I mean, that does not make for a safe nation, especially a nation like the United States, which really kind of should celebrate its safety and security.
Well, I'll actually go back to the comment I made about leverage, because if Donald Trump operates in a manner that's focused on finding leverage over his enemies, then he should know that America's adversaries operate very much the same way. And that's no coincidence. Autocrats operate like other autocrats. So whether it's China or Russia or Iran or North Korea, that's how they end up corrupting Western figures and officials and collecting intelligence, is they attempt to develop leverage over them. whether it's compromising material, whether it's taking on their financial debt. This is actually why when you're someone like me and you start your career as a government bureaucrat, you fill out this form called the SF-86, Standard Form 86, and it's all of this information, very personal information about your life. And you have to fill out that form to start the security clearance process, to either get a secret or a top secret security clearance. And that form asks about your finances, your family, your friends, any foreign nationals you know. And you do that because over decades and decades, we have learned there are tried and true tactics for our adversaries. And it's if they can get that financial leverage over you or penetrate your circle, they can get you, they can squeeze you, and they can get you to share classified information. Now, folks might be surprised to learn that the President of the United States doesn't have to fill out an SF-86. Why? Well, because the Constitution doesn't say, you know, when they win the majority of the Electoral College, now they must fill out form, you know, standard form, you know, 86. And so you have a person who ends up ascending to the highest office in the land, who's got access to the most sensitive information of the federal government, who actually hasn't gone through that sort of vetting. Donald Trump is not required in anywhere under U.S. law, nor any president, to disclose all of his financial dealings, to disclose his foreign contacts. Now, a lot of people do, as a matter of course, when they get elected, but Donald Trump could win this presidency again. And this is a hypothetical, but, you know, it could be that Vladimir Putin has found a way to bail out his companies or to do other things to ingratiate himself to Donald Trump. And we, the American people, might not know. Why does that matter? Because, well, then Donald Trump goes into the White House and doesn't want to do anything to piss off that foreign adversary that either has helped him or that could potentially hurt him. This is very real. This happens every year in the national security community with people at sort of a mid-level. And we know foreign governments are targeting Donald Trump because they consider him susceptible to influence. That's been declassified. That should really alarm everyone. And I'll tell you, we saw it in his administration. We would get nervous about him dealing with foreign governments because it was so easy for Donald Trump to get played. It really was. I mean, he was so susceptible to flattery and getting played. And you saw it, these foreign leaders learned in the first few months, that's all you had to do. Because you'd get right on these phone calls or read these transcripts of foreign leaders talking to Donald Trump. And they realized, oh, literally all I have to do is blow smoke up his, you know, up his ass and we'll win him over. And it worked. You know, he was very susceptible to those things. So there is a national security concern here. A bigger thing, Anthony, and I'm happy to get into it, will just be all the different ways he intends to use the security services of the U.S. federal government corruptly for his own benefit. That to me is also a national security threat, to have the intelligence community serving the president's personal whims rather than monitoring threats to the American people.
I want to talk about that next, especially when it comes to voting. One of the things I've been saying is that, you know, if you vote for Donald Trump this time, you may never get to vote again. So we'll talk about the, you know, the details of that in just a moment here on The Weekend Show. Have you ever wished that you had a whiter and brighter smile? Well, before you visit a dentist, you should know that their whitening treatments can be very expensive, and it's not just the price. You also have to book the appointment and schedule time away from work and family to sit in a dentist's office chair while undergoing the procedure. It's a hassle. Fortunately, now you can try Smile Actives at home or anywhere, anytime. Smile Actives offers a safe and affordable alternative to those expensive whitening procedures. I myself had a whitening procedure in the dentist chair several years ago. It was kind of painful, I didn't really enjoy it, and it didn't seem to last. Well, 97% of Smile Actives users in a clinical trial reported up to 6 shades whiter on average, all within 30 days. Simply add Smile Actives Pro Whitening Gel to your regular toothpaste. It's been formulated with PolyClean technology to boost stain removal and deliver active whitening ingredients into teeth's grooves and cracks to get better whitening. Smile Actives makes a teeth whitening gel that can simply be added to your toothpaste every time you brush your teeth. So no change in your routine, no extra time, and no more messy strips or trays or lights. People will start commenting on your whiter, brighter smile in just days. Smile Actives is the whitening boost your favorite toothpaste needs to give you the smile you deserve. Visit smileactives.com/weekend today to receive a special buy one, get one free offer with auto delivery, plus free shipping and handling. That's smileactives.com/weekend. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details. We're back on The Weekend Show. I'm Anthony Davis. Miles Taylor, the threat of a future Donald Trump presidency is not just about Democrats being sad losers. It's about a threat to the bigger picture, the safety and security of the nation as a whole. It's a vote between democracy with Joe Biden and demagoguery or dictatorship under Donald Trump. He's even admitted it. I mean, that's what's so frightening about this. And we're at a point now where there are Trump supporters considering a dictator and saying, well, maybe that is what we need after all. My concern is the vote and how Donald Trump, you know, with his fake electors scheme, that didn't work last time. So he sent the mob into the Capitol. That didn't work in the end. He really wants ultimate control. He's talked, as Vladimir Putin does, about, you know, being president forever. Just talk to me about, with the benefit of your expertise, about your fears going into a second Trump presidency regarding democracy and the loss of it.
I will say, Anthony, it's one of the reasons that I felt compelled to write Blowback. And I suspect a lot of your listeners have the same view as me. And I would urge them, you know, they may not need to read the message. This is something you should be sharing with friends or family members who think Donald Trump is going to operate a second term in some even-keeled way, or that maybe he's learned enough from the first term to operate in a more sober-minded fashion. That's not the case. And, you know, they don't have to take my word for it. I try to quote as many of these people as possible in the book that had served in that administration along with me as possible by name to describe what they predict will happen in a second term, the things that he wanted to do that he wasn't able to accomplish. So specifically, what does some of that look like? You can go department by department in the federal government and see some pretty frightening things that Trump would do in a second term. Let me give you one example. I spoke to several people who ran the Department of Veterans Affairs under Donald Trump, people who were his deputy secretaries, the general counsel, folks that were appointed by Trump in the White House to run that department. And I actually didn't think I was going to find anything there. It was kind of a box checking exercise. I wanted to talk to senior leaders of every department and agency under Trump. And I was like, okay, Veterans Affairs, I don't remember a lot of controversies. There were a few small ones. And I went and spoke to them and they said, oh yeah, I mean, in a second term, he's going to totally detonate the department. I was like, what do you mean detonate the department? It's the Department of, you know, Veterans Affairs. It gives benefits to people who've served our country in uniform. They said, yeah, well, he hated veterans. He called them lazy malingerers. That was a quote from one of the senior officials from Veterans Affairs. And they said he viewed it like a piggy bank because Donald Trump learned early in his administration he had more flexibility with the budget and the programs in the Department of Veterans Affairs than other departments. And so what he wanted to do was to upend the Department of Veterans Affairs and spend all that money on other things, things that were his priorities, things that Donald Trump felt like were more important than military veterans. And he sort of ruefully put those plans on a shelf when his advisors warned him that if he nuked the Department of Veterans Affairs before his reelection, he would lose because you don't touch America's military veterans. And so, again, his own people said, yeah, I mean, we convinced him to pause, but in a second term, he's going to take a wrecking ball to the VA because he wants to send that money to other projects. I mean, he wanted to take VA money and go build the border wall with it. You could want to build a border wall, but I think most people wouldn't want to build it on the backs of disabled American veterans. Yeah. That's the type of really cynical stuff that his own people are predicting he'll do in a second term. But it goes much deeper than that. And it gets much weirder than that, because I went and did another box checking exercise and talked to executives from the Department of Education under Trump. And I thought, I don't know, what are Department of Ed people going to tell me? It can't have been that bad over there. And when Betsy DeVos was secretary, Donald Trump and Stephen Miller wanted her to issue an order saying that students who were the children of illegal immigrants in public schools should be kicked out of public school because we shouldn't provide free education to the children of illegals. Now, they ended up pushing back on that, saying that we would get sued in the courts. They turned it around, the staff at the time under Betsy DeVos. But those same staff members told me, oh, no, in a second term, they're going to bring that executive order back and they're going to do it themselves. Imagine being a person who feels so angry towards immigrants to this country that you want to go kick their little third and fourth grade children out of American schools as a means of punishing them. That's pretty sick stuff. I want a more secure border than we currently have, but I'm not going to go punish children to make it happen. Those are the types of things you could see in a second term, to say nothing of what would happen in the national security departments and agencies. Had a lot of people under Trump tell me he'll use the wiretapping powers of the intelligence community to go after his adversaries. And you would think that's impossible. There's too many layers between the president and those authorities. Well, towards the end of his administration, he tried to stack the intelligence community with loyalists who would have been willing to carry out egregious orders along those lines. And certainly that's their intent in a second term. And in the department that I was helping to run, the Department of Homeland Security, Trump regularly wanted to go deploy DHS forces almost like a private militia to carry out his will. And we often said no to that. But even after I left, you saw him do this in Portland, where he ordered the deployment of counterterrorism forces that work within DHS for the first time in history on U.S. city streets to go put down, rallies and protests. That will be put on steroids in a second term. And you will see these things happen not as isolated incidents, but as standard U.S. government policy.
Yeah, that was very frightening. I talked to that a lot. We didn't know who those military people were. They were unmarked. They were using unmarked vehicles, and they were disappearing people off the streets. And, you know, that is the stuff that we would expect out of Russia or North Korea, but not the United States. I mean, these were American citizens that were being disappeared. Finally, I just want to look at a phrase that we hear from a lot of Republicans and potential Trump voters. And that is, well, when Trump was president, there was no war. And this is something that Trump uses himself. And obviously now we're in, there is a much more complex international situation than ever before, both with Ukraine, but also with Gaza. Trump is obviously denying having any involvement with this, despite really destabilizing much of the Middle East during his presidency. Could you just talk to those people who claim that, you know, a Trump presidency brings no war versus Joe Biden having to clean up Trump's mess?
My message to those people right now, in all sincerity, would be the reason that there was not a catastrophic global conflict during the Donald Trump presidency was not because of Donald Trump. It was despite Donald Trump. And let me tell you what I mean. I think if it were not for courageous people like my former boss, John Kelly, former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, to a certain extent, Rex Tillerson and others, there's quite a high likelihood that the United States would have been thrust into extraordinary conflict during the Trump presidency because of things he wanted to do. And even more specifically than that, I want to point to North Korea, because the way that the president was handling North Korea at the time so concerned all of us in his national security cabinet that for the first time in the history of the Department of Homeland Security in the United States, we had to hold private exercises to assess what would happen if Trump accidentally got us into a nuclear war and there was a nuclear strike on the U.S. homeland. To my knowledge, and I ran this by the Department of Homeland Security when I was publishing this book, there was no other circumstance since the department's been created where DHS had to do real life nuclear war planning because the president was putting us in such a volatile position. So if you think Trump kept us out of wars, what I'm telling you is, I'm not trying to say Miles kept us out of wars, but a lot of good people around Donald Trump prevented him from making decisions and taking actions that could have got us into the most dangerous conflict we've ever been in the modern history of the Republic, up to potentially and including World War II. I mean, the guy was playing with fire when it came to nuclear weapons, and we were really, really worried about it. And I will tell you, I can't divulge the details of those nuclear response planning exercises, but they were not good. And I will tell folks who think that we can survive a second Donald Trump term without getting into one of those conflicts, you haven't seen what I've seen on the other side of the wall of how terrifying that could actually be. And the man does not have the discipline to avoid getting us in those situations. And he certainly will not bring in a team that reins him in from making those impulsive decisions that could spiral into catastrophic conflict. That's how bad this could actually get. And I will tell you, on top of that, this was something else that I got to reveal for the first time in Blowback, is the department gave me permission to write a little bit about something that is privately referred to as the Doomsday Book. So there is a book inside the White House of break glass in case of emergency powers that the president of the United States allegedly has in the instance that the United States gets invaded or struck by a nuclear weapon or goes to war. And those powers allow the president to do some pretty extraordinary things to protect the country. However, in the wrong hands, those authorities could be misused to do some pretty terrible things to exert control over the United States. At the end of the Trump administration, there was a frenetic effort to keep that book out of the president's hands because people were worried that Trump would use those powers to keep the government from being transferred over to Joe Biden. And it very nearly ended up in the wrong hands of a MAGA sycophant who almost got installed in the job overseeing the security of the Doomsday Book. I'm very worried that in a second term, Donald Trump, the crown jewels aren't going to be safe from him. He will go and access those tools and authorities, but not to protect the United States, but to wield his influence over the American people in a way that is, by some definitions, quite clearly unconstitutional, anti-constitutional. And that's a fear. So I do expect there would be vastly greater geopolitical disorder in a second Trump administration as he pulls away from our Western allies and tries to get America to cozy up to its enemies, but also as Donald Trump tries to use some of those extraordinary foreign and defense powers here domestically.
It's a terrifying thought. He's not doing it alone, is he? We have the Heritage Foundation with Project 2025. We have Steve Bannon and various characters who really are going to help Trump this time around. And by removing anybody such as yourself from the administration who could stop him, that is the differential this time, isn't it? That last time there were people in place like Mark Milley, as you describe. This time he won't have those people around.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I always go back to the words of these people. Stephen Miller had told me personally that a second term would be a, quote, shock and awe blitz. That was his comment, is there would be a flurry of extraordinary executive orders when Trump took office. And, you know, Steve Bannon himself said that they would bring in the next generation of assassins. That's how he described the people that would come in. I don't think anyone would say that Jim Mattis and John Kelly and Mark Milley, you know, came in to be Trump's assassins. But that's who he wants to put in those jobs, is people who will, as the phrase suggests, essentially kill for the president. In some cases, that might be all too literally. That's how serious this is. And I think we have to view it with, you know, through that clear-eyed lens in order to actually prevent it.
Okay. We have to finish, but thank you for being so candid, and also for your bravery, and congratulations on the book.
Well, I appreciate it, Anthony. And like we said at the beginning, you know, we're going to award a Lamborghini to someone. It looks like Sue Coletti in Kansas. Sue, congratulations. You won a Lamborghini from Midas Touch. So really excited to deliver that to you.
Excellent.
We're just kidding.
Well, you're just kidding. Thank you, Miles Taylor. I'm Anthony Davis. Don't forget to support me and independent journalism at patreon.com/5minutenews. Download the 5-Minute News podcast and join me next week with a brand new special guest and more factual news to discuss on the 5-Minute News Weekend Show with Midas Touch.
Saving money on your outdoor project? Now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save money.